The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway for Thursday, August 4th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. One more campaign of airstrikes. No shock, no awe, and to what effect this time? It's expected to be a month-long assault against the Islamic State in Libya, also called ISIL. Libya itself is little more than wreckage from its revolution, with factions running rampant and the Islamic State poised to claim a North African prize. Local militias have been taking some heavy losses against the Islamic State, and U.S. airstrikes are aimed at helping those ground forces. At a news conference in Singapore this week, the president said these latest strikes answer a call for help from Tripoli.
It is in America's national security interests in our fight against ISIL to make sure that they're able to finish the job. And so we're working in partnership with them to assure that ISIL does not get a stronghold in Libya, even as Libya begins what is going to be a long process to establish a functioning government and security system there.
The president acknowledged that these airstrikes are a belated attempt to rectify what he has called a mistake of his administration, leaving a massive power void that gave ISIL lots of room to grow after the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi. Joining us to talk about this escalation is Mary Fitzgerald. She's a journalist specializing in Libya and contributing author to the book The Libyan Revolution and Its Aftermath. Mary, welcome.
Thank you for having me, John.
It seems as though the dissolution of Libya is following something of a pattern if you look at Syria and other countries in recent history where dictators have been deposed, and instead of the reinstallation of some government, it just falls apart. And to me, Libya looks almost like a partitioned country at this point.
Well, many Libyans would say that what the country is essentially experiencing now is a de facto partition, in that a political power struggle that erupted in summer 2014 and later resulted into what many consider a civil war has essentially divided the country between different rival governments. Right now, you have a UN-backed unity government, which the first layer of which is based in the capital Tripoli in western Libya, whereas in eastern Libya, you have another government, which was previously the internationally recognized government, that refuses to recognize or back that UN-supported unity government. So the political power struggle that has basically roiled Libya since 2014 has created a space in which a so-called Islamic State has basically built a presence and expanded.
And it's also the possibility that it would turn out like Cyprus, where there's a partition and one side refuses to recognize the other side. But what is it that is fueling the instability within Libya? Is it just the fact that ISIS wants a piece of this?
Well, I think we can boil down the political power struggle in Libya and the civil war resulting from it down to one essential point, and that is the battle for control over Libya's resources, its oil wealth. Libya has Africa's biggest oil reserves, much of which has been untapped up to now. And after the fall of Gaddafi in 2011, there was basically a rush to control the country, a rush by different armed and political factions. Remember, Libyans had no experience of democracy before 2011. Gaddafi was in power for 42 years. Before that, you had a monarchy. So everyone felt that the democratic transition for Libya post-Gaddafi was going to be a turbulent one, and so it has resulted. Though we have seen an intensification of that power struggle over the last 2 years for a whole range of reasons, in terms of a lot of the factors that were kind of feeding the instability post-2011, the proliferation of militias that had emerged not just during the uprising against Gaddafi in 2011, but also during the transitional period. They were all vying for political control, for control of the resources, for control of the oil wealth in different parts of the country.
And who's on top at this point as far as control of oil is concerned?
Well, I think you can say that Libya is a country where everyone and no one is in charge. I mean, the word control is a relative one in Libya. What you have now, essentially, because of that political power struggle over the last 2 years, is a real fragmentation and atomization of whatever power structures existed before everything started to unravel 2 years ago. And that is making the process of trying to find a solution to this ongoing civil war that put an end to this political power struggle, that has made that challenge even more difficult. Hence, we have right now in Libya three entities all claiming to be a government of some sort. But as many Libyans lament to me, they say, you know, we have several governments, but none can be considered to be governing in any real sense.
At what point does ISIL's presence become so entrenched that there's no choice but to really proceed down a path of power sharing, political power sharing with them, either in Libya or Syria or any of the other places where they seem totally entrenched? There doesn't seem to be a prospect of airstrikes resolving the political situation, yes?
No, not at all. And as I said, the presence of so-called Islamic State in Libya is a symptom instead of an actual cause of Libya's instability. The political power struggle is what needs to be tackled in Libya. Now, that unity government I mentioned earlier, which has been based in Tripoli since earlier this year, it's backed by the UN. It comes as a result of an almost two-year UN-mediated dialogue process. But that unity government is still very weak, very fragile. It doesn't have support from a range of factions, some of which are actively hostile towards it. And that it's very, very important that that unity government, if it is to survive, if it is to impose its authority and start to govern in any real sense, that it gets more support from a wider range of factions. So really, the deep malaise in Libya is not so much Islamic State, which is a problem, is a threat, but it's that deeper political power struggle, the utter lack of consensus, the utter lack of stakeholders deciding that they have to pull together, and too many people, too many factions playing a zero-sum game trying to control the oil wealth.
If through some international fatigue, the international community were to just let Libya go, what course is it on? And would that be a threat to the region or the rest of the world for that matter?
Well, there are many inside and out of Libya who've essentially described Libya now as a failed state. That's why the European powers in particular have really been very active in terms of this UN-mediated dialogue process, trying to find a solution to the political problem and stressing that a solution to the political problem must come either first or at the same time as efforts to tackle the security issue. There were concerns earlier this year that in the rush to tackle Islamic State in Libya, that the political process may be abandoned or left behind. I think now there's a realization that it actually has to happen in tandem, because without the political process, without a political solution, efforts to tackle insecurity, efforts to tackle the threat posed by Islamic State will only go so far.
Mary Fitzgerald is a reporter specializing in Libya and contributing author to the book The Libyan Revolution and Its Aftermath. Whenever the history books are written, the Obama era will undoubtedly be known for the 2010 Supreme Court 5-4 decision, commonly called the Citizens United case. The rules for how money can be spent by corporations and unions in political campaigns. That decision outraged President Obama, and he used his 2010 State of the Union address to express some of that outrage.
With all due deference to separation of powers, last week the Supreme Court reversed a century of law that I believe will open the floodgates for special interests, including foreign corporations, to spend without limit in our elections.
I don't know if you remember that moment, but what couldn't be heard, but you could see on camera, was Justice Samuel Alito shaking his head and angrily mouthing the words "not true" through that applause. So what is true? The Intercept has published a multi-part series on foreign influence in politics, outlining potential paths for foreign money to flow into the U.S. political process. John Schwartz is a reporter for The Intercept and joins me. John, thanks for being here.
Thanks very much for having me.
First of all, how much is foreign money capable of influencing U.S. politics, and how much has Citizens United greased the wheels?
The straightforward answer is no one knows. In this particular case, a California corporation that is owned by Chinese nationals gave $1.3 million to a super PAC that was supporting Jeb Bush, Right to Rise USA. And in this case, it is extraordinary that Obama predicted this, that he said that this could happen, that he was roundly criticized, if people go back and look, to 2010. Even PolitiFact called him mostly wrong for saying that Citizens
United made this possible. Yeah, he was overreacting, being emotional, but no.
That's exactly right. It was a very unpopular thing for him to say at the time. But as we demonstrate in these articles, he was completely right.
So the Saudis could start a PAC and fund it to the tune of $2 billion and, no one would know the difference.
As we discuss in these articles, the most interesting thing is that people saw Obama saying this and criticized him in public. In private, the smart Republican campaign finance lawyers and perhaps Democratic campaign finance lawyers, but we can't say that for sure, thought, you know, in public, everyone is saying he's wrong. In private, hey, he's right. Let's go get that money. And we found a memo that had been written by Charlie Spies, who is perhaps the most prominent and influential Republican campaign finance lawyer, which was essentially a roadmap about how a U.S. corporation, which is owned by foreign nationals, can put unlimited amounts of money into U.S. politics. The most important thing that his memo explains is that a corporation, if it is owned and operated in another country, can't put money into U.S. politics. But a corporation that is organized under the laws of the United States can. And so what that means is this corporation, American Pacific International Capital, is in fact incorporated in California. And that makes it a U.S. company, and it makes it, according to the law, American money.
What do you make of real estate transactions on the part of U.S. diplomats who sell their houses to the Chinese and then, you know, retain their influence within the U.S. government?
That's one of the things we found that really did surprise us. Even if it's not illegal, it does seem as though it's something that a U.S. diplomat would want to avoid. Gary Locke was first a Democrat who was the governor of Washington State, and then he was Obama's first Secretary of Commerce. And then in 2011, I think, he was appointed to be the U.S. ambassador to China. Now, he already knew the Chinese couple at the center of this story. He'd already had some contact, I believe, lobbying for them in the past. And then in 2013, while he was still U.S. ambassador to China, he apparently very badly wanted to sell his house that he still owned in the D.C. area from when he'd been Secretary of Commerce. And he was looking for someone to sell it to, and they said, hey, we'll buy it. And they did. Now, did that break any specific ethical rules? Maybe, maybe not. But I think most Americans would say, you know, hey, we would prefer it when you are the ambassador to a country that you not get involved with business deals with people from that country.
Is it the case that that enhances the relationship between this couple and the ambassador?
Absolutely. I'm sure that's why they did it. And, you know, after he stepped down as ambassador, he went on to become senior advisor to American Pacific International Capital. As far as we know, he's still doing that to this day. You can see his picture on their website. And so, you know, again, with a lot of these things, it's very difficult to say there's like a one-to-one relationship between business transactions and money and decisions that are made by government officials. What I think most people would like to see is just none of this happening, so we don't have to investigate it, so we don't have to ask the question.
Is that the Bernie Sanders scenario?
I think absolutely. I would encourage people to look at the suggestions that Sanders has, not just for Citizens United, but for all kinds of reforms to the American political process. He has a lot of great ideas. Hillary Clinton has, at least pro forma, adopted a lot of them. So if these things were to become law, that would be for sure a positive step forward. We wouldn't have to worry as much about this kind of thing. But in particular, I would say that Citizens United is the biggest one. Like, if this remains as law of the land, we just will really never know what's going on with our political process.
Does Citizens United enable foreign citizens to influence the U.S. government? It's a report by John Schwartz, who's a reporter for The Intercept. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Consider the lowly dental floss.
By myself, I wouldn't have no boss, but I'd be raising my lonely dental floss.
Raising my lonely dental floss.
$2 billion is probably enough to support a few real dental floss tycoons that Frank Zappa was dreaming about back in the 70s. But are they worrying up Montana way about a well-read report this week from the Associated Press saying there's no evidence that flossing really works in the long term? Flossers are passionate folks and don't take such disputations lightly. Dr. Scott Tomar is the editor of the Journal of Evidence-Based Dental Practice and professor at the University of Florida College of Dentistry. He says the benefits of flossing are backed up by the evidence.
Well, we've certainly known for quite a while that dental floss is effective at removing plaque, the bacterial buildup on the area between the teeth, and removing debris between the teeth. And there's actually pretty good evidence of short-term benefits, things like preventing and reducing gingivitis, the transient inflammation of the gums.
Where is this report coming from?
Well, I'd say the evidence for longer-term outcomes, things like tooth decay starting on the side surfaces of the teeth, and an advanced form of gum disease known as periodontitis, the evidence is pretty sparse and not very strong for those outcomes.
What are those reasons?
Well, to do the types of studies that you would need to do in order to establish that relationship would be incredibly difficult, incredibly expensive, and at this day and age, probably not even practical.
Is it the case that there are certain features of our teeth that respond to our care of those teeth and the dental hygiene that we use, the amount of brushing that we do, flossing, that sort of thing? But then there are other aspects of our teeth that are genetically based, that are related to inherited factors that we have limited control over.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, most of the diseases that we deal with in dentistry, similar to other diseases, are multifactorial. So certainly there are things that we can do to reduce our risk for things like dental caries or tooth decay, periodontitis. There are certainly things that we can do in terms of diet, in terms of avoiding use of tobacco products.
So in this Associated Press report, there is no reason to stop flossing here.
I would say, based on the best available evidence that we have, I feel comfortable still recommending flossing based on what we've established as the short-term benefits of it. And again, I think it's important for people to understand that the absence of evidence of effectiveness is not at all equivalent to evidence that something doesn't work. And so this is a situation where, in order to get the type of evidence that we would need for flossing preventing periodontitis or dental caries, we would need to follow people for a period of years to monitor changes that progress pretty slowly. So it would be studies that would include, probably thousands of people followed for a period of years. Imagine the difficulty of randomizing somebody to not floss for the next 3 to 5 years. It's just not feasible and perhaps not even ethical based on what we know about at least the short-term benefits.
Are you a flosser?
Absolutely.
And are people who floss better people than people who don't floss?
I wouldn't say that they're better, but
No. None of this. No, come on. What do you really think?
I think that there's certainly good evidence that that flossing will reduce, at least in the short term, your risk for things like gingivitis, that it will remove and break up the bacterial colonization.
Yeah. Okay, first date, you go home, you brush your teeth, you floss, your new girlfriend doesn't floss, it's over, right?
Not at all. Like any behavior change, what we try to do is provide the information and hope that the other person voluntarily adopts better health behaviors.
All right. So you'd be selling her on flossing, but you're happily married. Is that the case?
That is the case, yes.
All right. Dr. Tomar, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Scott Tomar is the editor of the Journal of Evidence-Based Dental Practice and a professor at the University of Florida College of Dentistry. The Olympics haven't started, and among the biggest challenges facing Olympic competitors, officials, spectators, and record keepers this year is the impact of performance-enhancing drugs. There is a broad consensus based on experience with professional sports that the International Olympic Committee and the World Anti-Doping Agency are just not ready to handle or even effectively monitor the allegations and practice of doping by athletes participating in the Olympic Games. So, who are you going to call? Is he the dope buster? Senator George Mitchell is the former U.S. Senate Majority Leader. He also chaired investigations into the use of performance-enhancing drugs in Major League Baseball. Senator Mitchell, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
How would you characterize the problem of trying to contain or in any sense control performing-enhancing drugs in something like the Olympics?
Think of it in a related sense as crime. Every state, every country has laws against crime. No one expects crime to come to a complete end because of those laws. Human nature is such that there will always be people who commit wrongful actions. It's the same way in the area of performance-enhancing drugs and athletic performance. The rewards are so great that there will always be people willing to take the risk of denunciation and perhaps even legal violation by enhancing their performance through the use of drugs. So we have to keep ahead of it, because at this very moment, John, in many parts of the world, there are people engaged in the pursuit of trying to come up with new drugs that will enhance performance but will not be detectable.
I've lived through this steroid era in baseball, and so have you. And, you know, it's been an issue that has really dogged sports for the last couple of decades. But can I push on the principle here for just a moment?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm a guy who gets around in a wheelchair, right? And in some ways, you know, when I got in a wheelchair back in the 70s, I mean, wheelchairs were junk back in the 70s. And over time, the technology has improved them, and now I'm much more efficient in the way that I get around. If it can be said that, you know, humans performing at their highest level is a kind of evolution of the human species, what's to say that you can't also use drugs or chemicals as an input to improve your performance? Why is that a no-no when everything else seems to be fine?
We make rational judgments all of the time in our lives based upon the standards that our and preceding societies have established for appropriate behavior. The American justice system is replete with error because it's implemented by human beings. And it contains a number of provisions that rest upon moral foundations. For example, what is a reasonable man? In the law, it's an important determination. What is personal intent? Highly subjective and individual. And yet they are the very base, important parts of the basis of our criminal justice system. So over many years, over many centuries, human beings have made decisions on what is or is not appropriate behavior. Technology and science are neutral. They can be employed for valid, high-minded, moral purposes. They can be employed for the opposite kind of purposes. So my own belief is that these standards, these judgments, while constantly reviewable in the wake of changing circumstances and, most importantly, new discoveries, that there is a rational basis for making a distinction between improvements in the wheelchair that you have used over the past several decades and improvement in human performance that can be artificially achieved by the use of, say, anabolic steroids to enhance athletic performance. But I acknowledge it's a subjective judgment. But as I conclude with what I began, subjective judgments are an important part, indeed an integral part, of the foundation of our whole system of democratic values, our justice system, and almost every other aspect of our daily lives.
One last question on this subject. If it was the case that every athlete in the world had equal access to all of the performance-enhancing drugs that exist, would it change your view of the principle?
No, not at all, for a number of reasons. The first off, we don't know for sure how seriously harmful to the individual who uses drugs are over the long term. The second is the effect on children. One of the underreported, understated, underrecognized issues here is the extent to which, in most societies, sports figures are role models for young people, and it has a derivative and highly negative effect upon young people coming up who don't have the ability to make the kind of conscious, rational judgments that come with adulthood and maturity.
Have the Russians crossed a line in what appears to be an ethos of use of performance-enhancing drugs in international sport competitions?
Yes, but they're not the first to do so. Of course, you will recall decades ago the scandals regarding East Germany's state-sponsored and state-run program of the illegal use of drugs. But if the allegations are true and the evidence so far by those who've heard it suggests it is, then the Russian government, agencies of the government, supervised, implemented, organized cheating programs to permit their athletes to gain an unfair advantage over those against who they competed.
If it were up to you, would you ban the Russians?
I would not have banned every single Russian athlete. I think that's unfair to the individual athlete. It violates our principles of individual responsibility and justice applied in individual circumstances, not group condemnation. The government agency deserves the condemnation. But I don't think it should go to the individual athletes who have not been demonstrated to have used drugs.
Senator Mitchell, it's always great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, John.
Senator George Mitchell, former U.S. Senate Majority Leader, he chaired investigations into the use of performance-enhancing drugs in Major League Baseball and of corruption in the site selection procedures of the Olympic Games.
Music don't change the world.
There's something happening here.
You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out.
John is in the basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on a pavement thinking about the government.
I'm going to tell all you fascists you may be surprised.
Music don't change the world. Only the audience can change the world. But a good songwriter can offer a different perspective.
If you need a little cheering up out there, I can definitely introduce you to someone who will take the edge off.
It's about the sensation of this celebratory excitement.
It would be hard to match the soothing effect of spending time with Andrew W.K. He's a vagabond, a musician, and takes everything you say at face value. And in our People Get Ready series all about protest music, Andrew wants you to join his party party.
Campaign for the spirit of this feeling.
Praises of which he sings about every chance he gets on a 50-state motivational speaking tour.
I've created the illusion that I'm doing a lot of different things, but it's actually just one very simple thing called partying.
And as a political message, the party party would want the world to do what?
Party. Yeah, because again, very simple, very one-dimensional. But the great thing about partying is, as far as the dimension goes, it may be a single dimension, but it's quite vast. There's a lot of room in there. But they're all fused together with a sense of joy and a sense of energized enthusiasm about being alive.
It might be argued that the party sounds like a dropout of the current system, that basically you're advocating a kind of get away from politics, get away from voting, and get away from the current system.
No, not personally, although I understand and certainly respect someone who does feel that way. But I think ideally we want to create an atmosphere almost to clear our heads so that we can dive deeper in, not just to social issues, cultural issues, governmental issues, but to the issues of living day to day. And if we're so overwhelmed that we want to tap out, then we know we're doing something wrong. We want to get deeper into life. So I'm trying to actually, rather than tackle any one particular issue, I'm trying to work at the foundation that lies beneath all these issues and strengthen that so that we can then have that renewed sense of optimism or just at least pure energy to go into life. Fixing things from the top down, I don't think it works as well as fixing from the inside out.
And parties are most effective from the inside out.
The party spirit asks us to retain an almost irrational amount of optimism, where even the negative sort of falls into a positive category. It's kind of a transcendental positivity, where we say we're going to start with the first and foremost fact that I exist, and we're going to celebrate that. It doesn't mean that everything's good. It doesn't mean that there won't be bad things or hard things, but that we're going to face them with as much, again, possibly even unfounded positivity as we can, because what else is the other choice? But I'm here as a representative of a feeling that I really do think is bound up in some shred of truth.
In the party itself, what kind of a party are we talking about? Does any party qualify? Do you have a specific rule of engagement for a party, how it begins, middle and end, that sort of thing? What's served at the party?
Water is the most important thing to serve anywhere at all times. And that is much like the foundation. Partying is the water of the spirit. You know, you can't live without water. You can't exist without some shred of essential joy. You know, they say happiness is felt for a particular reason, but joy can be felt for no reason in particular. And in that way, again, it seems unfounded. It seems undeserved, or some could even say it's irresponsible when faced with so much darkness, with so much shadow, and so much calamity, that how can we feel joy? But maybe that's when that type of joy is the most crucial, because it feeds us this kind of primal energy.
I voted for a bunch of presidents. I've seen them come, I see them go, they promise you a bunch of stuff, and things don't get better.
It's hard to decide who to vote for because nobody is addressing any issues that average citizens like me care about. I'm not sure where this country is headed, really.
Hello, my name is Andrew W.K., and I have a very important message. It's no secret that the majority of Americans are frustrated, disillusioned, and concerned with the current state of our nation. Today, I'm proud to announce the formation of the Party Party.
What do you think people would get out of seeing your political ad?
I don't really know. I didn't expect people to react as well to it as they did, so I think most people probably already thought the same thing. But I had no particular agenda other than this was something I had felt, and it seemed like it continued a tradition of pointing out the unnecessary binary separations. You know, it's very appealing to our mind to have things split down the middle. Even when I'm talking about negative and positive, there's something very natural about that. But there's times when it just doesn't seem to cover the complexities of what it is to be a person.
What would you hope to be the outcome, the best case scenario for the party's connection with American voters? And, you know, you're talking about positive joy, and boy, there are a lot of angry voters out there.
Yeah, and they have every reason to feel that way. I'm not telling anyone to feel any other way than they do. It's just, what do we do forward? And do we really want to feel like this perpetually? And how can we get over it? Or is it a feeling to have for the sake of having it?
Do you campaign?
All my life. That's all I do, is campaign for the spirit of this feeling. Again, I'm just a representative. That's why I don't cloud it up. It's not about me. It's about the sensation of this this celebratory excitement. So what if we could take that spirit with us, even a shred of it, and go throughout the rest of our trials and tribulations with that in mind? Can we find at least one thing to hold on to that bonds us, even if it's just the fact that we're all on this planet at the same time? You know, we're in it together whether we like it or not. So what are we going to do about it?
Andrew W.K., thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Andrew W.K. for Yourself on his 50-state speaking tour, The Power of Partying. We, the people of the United States of America, just want to party. That's pretty simple. Well, here's something else to take with you today. Even before the opening ceremony, the U.S. has won gold. That's right. All this is played out in Hong Kong, host of the 57th International Mathematical Olympiad, the world's most prestigious problem-solving competition for high school students. The competition included teams from over 100 countries. The winning U.S. team score was 214 out of a possible 252, which put the U.S. ahead of South Korea and China. Nice. Congratulations to the students, Ankan Bhattachara, Michael Kural, Alan Liu, Juyao Peng, Ashwin Sa, and Yung Yao, head coach Po Shen Lo, and deputy coach Razvan Gelka. Their roadies were a guy named Joe Smith. Here's some more numbers, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.